This is a special recording, The Count of Monte Cristo. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, my name is Kelly Wall from North Carolina Reading Service. I will be reading for Harrison 2 from The Count of Monte Cristo by Alexander Dumas, translated and with an introduction and notes by Robin Buss. Chapter 20. The Graveyard of the Chateau d'If. Stretched out on the bed, weakly outlined by a dusty ray of light from the window, there was a sack of coarse cloth, under the broad folds of which one could vaguely distinguish a long, stiff shape. This was Faria's last winding sheet, which, according to the turnkeys, had cost so little. So all was finished. Between Dantes and his old friend, there was already a gulf. He could no longer see those eyes wide open, as if looking beyond death. He could no longer clasp that industrious hand which, for him, had lifted the veil that covered arcane matters. Faria, that good and valuable companion to whom he had become so strongly attached, now existed only in his memory. He sat down at the head of this awful bed and lapsed into a deep and bitter melancholy. Alone, he was once more alone. He had fallen back into silence. He was faced once more with nothingness. Alone, he had no longer had even the sight or the sound of the voice of the only human being who still bound him to this earth. Would it not be better for him, like Faria, to go and ask God to explain the enigma of life, even at the risk of passing through the dark gate of suffering? The idea of suicide had been driven away by his friend's presence, but returned like a ghost and rose up beside Faria's corpse. "If I could die," he said, "I shall go where he has gone. I should certainly find him again. But how can I die?" "It is easy," he added, laughing. "I have only to remain here, throw myself on the first person who enters and strangle him. They will guillotine me." But as often happens in great sorrow, as in great storm, the abyss lies between the crests of two waves. Dante shrank from the idea of so dishonorable a death and rapidly went from this feeling of despair to a burning thirst for life and freedom. "Die? No, no," he cried. It was not worth living so long and suffering so much to die now. Death was welcome previously, when I made a resolution to meet it many years ago. But now it would truly be conceding too much to my miserable fate. No, I want to live. I want to struggle to the end. No, I want to recover the happiness that has been taken away from me. And forgetting that, before I die, I have my enemies to punish, and who knows, perhaps a few friends to reward. But now that I am forgotten here, I shall not escape my dungeon, except in the same way as Faria. At these words, Edmond remained motionless, his gaze fixed, like a man who had suddenly been struck by an idea, but one that appalls him. At once he got up, put his hand on his forehead, as if suffering from dizziness, walked around the room two or three times, and returned to the bed. "Ah," he exclaimed, "where did that idea come from?" "From you, God? Since only the dead leave this place freely, let us take the place of the dead." And without wasting any time in reconsidering the decision, as if to avoid giving his thoughts the opportunity to annihilate his deepest resolve, he bent over the ghastly sack, opened it with the knife Faria had made, removed the body, dragged it into his own cell, put it in his bed, covered his head with the scrap of linen that he was accustomed to wear on his own, drew his blanket over it, kissed its icy brow for the last time, and tried to close the eyes, which still remained stubbornly open, terrifying, because there was no thought behind them. After that, he turned the head to the wall so that the jailer, when he brought the evening meal, would think that he was asleep, as quite often happened. Then he returned to the tunnel, dragged the bed against the wall, went back to the other cell, took the needle and thread out of the wardrobe, threw off his rags so that they would feel naked flesh under the cloth, slipped into the empty sack, lay down in the same position at the body, and sewed it up from inside. If anyone had unfortunately chanced to come in at that moment, they would have heard his heart beating. Dantes could easily have waited until the evening visit, but he was afraid that between now and then the governor might change his mind and take away the body. In that case, his last hope would be gone. Now, in any case, his plan was fixed. Here is what he intended to do. If, during the journey out of the cell, the gravediggers realized that they were carrying a living man instead of a corpse, Dantes would not give them time to gather their wits. He would split the sack from top to bottom with a sharp lunge of the knife and take advantage of their terror to escape. If they tried to stop him, he would use the knife. If they took him to the burial ground and put him in a grave, he would allow himself to be covered with earth. Then, since it was night, the gravediggers would hardly have turned their backs before he would tunnel out of the soft earth and escape. He hoped the soil would not be too heavy for him to lift it. If he was wrong and the earth proved to be too heavy, he would suffocate. And so much the better. All would be over. Dantes had not even eaten since the previous day, but he had not thought of his hunger that morning, and he still did not notice it. His position was too precarious for him to waste time on thinking of anything else. The first danger that threatened was that of the jailer, bringing his supper at 7 o'clock, would notice the substitution. Luckily, Dantes had many times received the jailer's visit lying down, either through misanthropy or fatigue. In such cases, the man usually put the bread and soup on the table and left without speaking to him. This time, however, the jailer might lapse from his habitual silence, say something, and when Dantes did not reply, go over to the bed and discover the deception. At 7 o'clock approach, Dantes began to suffer in earnest. One hand was pressed against his heart, attempting to stifle its beating, while the other wiped the sweat from his brow as it streamed along his temples. From time to time, a shudder would run through his whole body and seize his heart in an icy grip. At such moments, he thought he would die. The hours passed without bringing any sound of movement in the fortress, and Dantes realized that he escaped the first danger, which was a good sign. Finally, at around the time appointed by the governor, footsteps were heard in the stairway. Edmond realized that the moment had come. He summoned up all his courage, holding his breath. He would have been happier could he have stifled the beating of his pulse in the same way. The footsteps, two sets of them, stopped outside the door. Dantes guessed that this must be the two gravediggers who had come to fetch him. This suspicion became a certainty when he heard the noise that they made setting down the bier. The door opened and a muffled light reached Dante's eyes. Through the cloth covering him, he saw two shapes approach the bed. At the door was a third, carrying a lantern. The two had come over to the bed, each grasped one end of the sack. "He's still pretty heavy, this one, for such a thin old man," one said, raising the head. "They do say that each year adds 0.5 pound to the weight of the bones," the other replied, taking the feet. "Have you made your knot?" the first asked. "It would be stupid to carry any unnecessary weight. I'll make it when we get there." "Quite right, let's go." "What knot is this?" Dantes wondered. They carried the supposed corpse from the bed to the bier. Edmond stiffened, the better to play dead. They put him down on the stretcher in the funeral procession, led and lit by the man with the lantern, went up the stairs. Suddenly, he was bathed in the fresh, sharp air of night. Dantes recognized the mistral and was filled with a sudden feeling of both delight and anguish. The men carrying him went about 20 paces, then stopped and set the bier down on the ground. One of them went away. Dantes could hear his footsteps on the pavement. "Where can I be?" he wondered. "You know something? He's not at all light," said the one who had stayed behind, sitting down on the edge of the stretcher. Dante's first instinct had been to escape, but luckily he resisted it. "Give us some light here, you brute," said the one who had moved away. "Otherwise, I'll never find what I'm looking for." The man with the lantern obeyed, even though, as we have seen, the request was couched in rather offensive terms. What can he be looking for? Dantès wondered. No doubt a spade. A satisfied exclamation indicated that the gravedigger had found whatever it was he needed. At last, the other said, you made a hard job of it. Yes, but there's nothing lost by the delay. At these words, he went over to Edmond, who heard something heavy and resounding being put down beside him. At the same moment, a rope was bound tightly and painfully around his feet. Well, have you done the knot? Asked the gravedigger who had remained idle. And done it well, said the other, I guarantee. In that case, let's be going. And the bier was lifted and carried forward. They took about 50 paces, then stopped to open a gate before carrying on. The sound of waves breaking against the rocks on which the castle was built reached Dantès more and more clearly as they went on. The weather is bad, said one of the men. I'd not like to be out at sea tonight. Yes, the abbé runs a serious risk of getting wet, said the other, and they burst out laughing. Dantès did not entirely understand this joke, but the hair still rose on his neck. Good, here we are, said the first man. Further on, said the other. You remember that the last one stayed behind, caught on the rocks, and the next day the governor told us what lazy devils we were. They took 4 or 5 steps more, still going up. Then Dantès felt them take him by the head and feet and swing him. One, said the gravediggers. 2, 3. At this moment, Dantès felt himself being thrown into a huge void, flying through the air like a wounded bird, then falling into a terrifying descent that froze his heart. Although he was drawn downward by some weight that sped his flight, it seemed to him that the fall lasted a century. Finally, with a terrifying noise, he plunged like an arrow into icy water, and he cried out, his cry instantly stifled by the water closing around him. Dantès had been thrown into the sea, and a 36-pound cannonball tied to his feet was dragging him to the bottom. The sea is the graveyard of the Château d'If. Chapter 21. The Island of Tiboulen. Though stunned and almost suffocated, Dantès still had the pressure of mind, the presence of mind, to hold his breath, and since, as we have said, his right hand was prepared for any eventuality. Holding the knife open, he quickly slit the cloth and put out his arm, then his head. But then, despite his attempts to raise the cannonball, he felt himself being continually dragged down. So he bent over to search for the rope restraining his legs, and with one last despairing effort, caught it just as he was suffocating. Kicking powerfully, he rose free to the surface of the sea, while the weight dragged the coarse linen that had almost become his shroud down into the unknown depth. Dantès stayed no longer than was necessary to take a breath before diving once more. The first precaution that he had to take was to avoid being seen. When he emerged a second time, he was already at least 50 yards from the place where he had fallen. Above him, he saw a black, lowering sky, across which the clouds were being rapidly swept by the wind, from time to time revealing a small patch of blue from which a star shone. In front of him was a dark, roaring plain, its waves starting to seethe as at the approach of a storm, while behind him, blacker than the sea, blacker than the sky, like a threatening phantom, rose the granite giant, its somber peak like a hand outstretched to grasp its prey. On the topmost rock was a lantern shining two human forms. It seemed to him that the two forms were bending uneasily over the sea. The strange gravediggers must indeed have heard the cry that escaped him as he flew through the air. So Dantès dived again and swam underwater for a considerable distance. He had once been quite used to doing this and would formerly, in the Cove of the Pharaoh, have attracted many admirers around him, who often proclaimed him the most accomplished swimmer in Marseille. When he came back to the surface, the lantern had vanished. Now he must find his bearings. Of all the islands around the Château d'If, Ratonneau and Pomègue are the nearest. but Ratchanoe and Pomeg are inhabited. So is this the little island of Dom? The safest landfall was therefore on either Tibolen or Lemaire, and these two islands lie a league away from the Chateau d'If. Even so, it was one of these two that Dantes decided to make for. But how could he find them in the depth of the night that was deepening moment by moment around him? But then, shining like a star, he noticed the Planier lighthouse. If he swam directly towards the light, he would leave Tibolen a little to his left. So if he were to swing a small distance to the left, he would be heading for the island. However, as we have said, it was at least a league from the Chateau d'If to Tibolen. Often in their prison, Faria had told the young man when he saw him depressed and languid, "Dantes, you must not give way to this stability. If you do manage to escape and you have failed to keep up your strength, you will drown." Beneath the heavy, bitter swell, Dantes once more heard these words in his ears, and he hurried back to the surface to plow through the waves and test whether he had indeed lost his power. He was overjoyed to find that his enforced idleness had deprived him of none of his strength and agility, and to find that he was still master of this element in which he had gambled as a child. In any event, fear, that swift tormentor, doubled his vigor. Rising on the crest of the waves, he listened to find out if he could hear any noise. Each time that he reached the highest point of a wave, he quickly surveyed the visible horizon and tried to penetrate the blackness. Every wave that climbed a little higher than the rest looked to him like a boat pursuing him. So he strove all the harder, which certainly took him further onward, but also threatened to exhaust him more quickly. Yet he did swim, and the fearless fortress had faded somewhat into the mists of night. He could no longer see it, but he felt it still. An hour passed, during which Dantes, buoyed by the sense of freedom that had spread through his whole body, continued to drive on through the waves on the course he had set himself. "Now let's see," he thought. "I have been swimming for almost an hour, but with a contrary wind, I must have lost a quarter of my speed. However, unless I have mistaken the direction, I must now be close to the island of Tibolen. But what if I'm mistaken?" The swimmer felt a shudder pass through him. He tried to float for a moment to give himself a rest, but the sea was getting heavier all the time, and he soon realized that such respite, which he had counted on having, was impossible. "Well, so be it," he said. "I shall go on until the end, until my arms fail, until cramp seizes my whole body, and then I shall sink." And he began to swim with the energy and urgency of despair. Suddenly it seemed that the sky, already so dark, grew still darker, and that a thick, heavy, impenetrable cloud was coming down over him. At the same time, he felt a sharp pain in his knee. His imagination immediately told him that he must be the shock of a bullet, and that he would instantly hear the report of a rifle. But there was no explosion. Dantes put out his hand, and he felt something. He brought up his other leg and touched solid ground. It was then that he saw that it had been taken for a cloud. 20 yards ahead of him rose a mass of oddly shaped rocks that looked like a vast fire, solidified just at the moment when it was burning most fiercely. This was the island of Tibolen. Dante stood up and took a few steps forward. Then he lay down, thanking God, on these points of granite that seemed softer to him at that moment than the softest bed. Then, despite the wind, despite the storm, despite the rain that was starting to fall, exhausted as he was, he fell asleep with that delicious sleep of the man whose body is numbed but whose mind is awake to the knowledge of unhoped-for good fortune. After an hour, Edmond woke to the sound of an immense clap of thunder. The storm had broken in the heaven and was beating the air with its flashing flight. From time to time, a shaft of lightning shot from the sky like a fiery snake, illuminating the waves and the clouds that plunge headlong after each other like the breakers of a vast abyss. Dantes, with a sailor's eye, had judged rightly. He had landed on the first of the two islands, which is Tibalin. He knew that it was a naked rock, open to the elements and shelterless. When the storm was over, he would plunge back into the sea and make for the island of Lemaire, no less deserted, but wider and consequently more welcoming. An overhanging rock did offer him some temporary shelter, and he took refuge under it. At almost the same moment, the storm broke in all its fury. Edmond felt the rock beneath which he was hiding tremble, and the waves, breaking against the base of the huge pyramid, reached his hiding place. Safe as he was in the midst of the shattering noise and these blinding flashes of light, he was seized with a sort of dizziness. He felt as though the very island were shaking beneath him, and from one moment to the next would break its moorings like a vessel at anchor and drag him down with it into the midst of the huge maelstrom. At this, he remembered that he had not eaten for 24 hours. He was hungry and thirsty. He stretched out his hands and his neck and drank some rainwater from a hollow in the rock. As he was lifting his head, a shaft of lightning, which seemed to crack open the heavens as far as the foot of God's radiant throne, lit up the scene. But its light, Dante saw a little fishing boat appear, like a phantom slipping from the crest of a wave into the abyss, driven forward both by the waves and by the storm, beneath the Isle Lemaire and the Cap Croisille, a quarter of a league away from him. A second later, the phantom reappeared on the crest of another wave, coming towards him at fearful speed. Dantes wanted to shout. He looked for a scrap of cloth that he could wave in the air to show them that they were heading for destruction. But they could see it perfectly well for themselves. In the light of another shaft of lightning, the young man saw four men hanging onto the mast in the rigging, while a fifth held the bar of a broken helm. No doubt these men, whom he saw, could also see him, for desperate cries were carried across to him on the whistling gusts. Above the mast, twisted like a reed, a tattered sail was flapping rapidly over and over against the air. Suddenly the ropes that still held it broke, and it vanished, carried away into the dark depths of the sky, like a great white bird silhouetted against a black cloud. At the same time, he heard a fearful crack and cries of agony. Grasping his rock like a sphinx above the abyss, Dantes glimpsed the little boat in the light of another flash, broken. Amid its wreckage, heads with terrified faces and hands reached for the sky. Then darkness returned. The awful scene had lasted the lifetime of a lightning bolt. Dantes hastened down the slippery rocks at the risk of himself falling into the sea. He looked, listened, but could hear and see nothing. No more cries, no more human struggle. Only the storm, that great act of God, continued to roar with the wind and to foam with the waves. Little by little, the wind subsided. Westwards, across the sky, rolled huge gray clouds which seemed to have been discolored by the storm. Patches of blue sky reappeared with stars that shone brighter than ever. Soon, in the east, a long reddish band lit up the undulating blue-black line of the horizon. The waves danced, and instantly a light sped across their crests, transforming each one into a mane of gold. Day was breaking. Dantes remained motionless and silent before this great spectacle, as if seeing it for the first time. Indeed, in all the years that he had been at the Chateau d'If, he had forgotten it. He turned back to look at the fortress, sweeping his eyes across the whole arc of the land and the sea. The dark pile rose out of the midst of the waves with the imposing majesty common to all motionless objects, which seemed at once to watch and to command. It must have been about 5 o'clock. The sea was growing calmer all the time. In 2 or 3 hours, Edmond thought, the turnkey will go into my room, find the body of my poor friend, recognize it, look in vain for me, and give the alarm. Then they will find the hole and the tunnel. They will question the men who threw me into the sea, who must have heard me cry out. Immediately, ships full of soldiers will set out in pursuit of the unfortunate fugitive, who could not have gone far. The cannon will be fired to warn everyone on the coast not to give shelter to any man who appears, naked and starving. The spies and alguazils of Marseille will be informed. They will search the coast while the governor of the Chateau d'If will be searching the sea. So hunted down at sea, hemmed in on land, what will become of me? I am hungry and thirsty. I have even lost my life-saving knife because it hampered me while I was swimming. I am at the mercy of the first peasant who wants to earn 20 francs by handing me in. I have no strength, no ideas, no resolve left. Oh my God, haven't I suffered enough? Now can you do more for me than I can do for myself? Just as Edmund was uttering this ardent prayer, in a sort of delirium due to his exhaustion and the lightness of his head, and anxiously turning towards the Chateau d'If, he saw off the point of the Isle de Pomègue its lantern sail against the horizon, like a seagull skimming the waves. A little ship, which only the eye of a sailor would have recognized as a Genoese tartan, which appeared on the still indistinct line of the sea. It was coming from the port of Marseille and heading out to sea, driving the shining rain in front of a sharp prow that cut the sea ahead of its swelling sides. "Just think," Edmund exclaimed, "in half an hour I could have reached that ship if I were not afraid of being questioned, recognized as an escaped prisoner, and taken back to Marseille. What can I do? What can I say? What story can I invent to deceive them? These people are all smugglers, nearly pirates, pretending to ply the coast. They scour it for booty. They would rather sell me than do a good deed for nothing. Let's wait." "But it is impossible to wait. I am dying of hunger. In a few hours, I shall have exhausted the little strength that remains to me. In any case, the time of the warder's rounds is approaching. The alarm has not yet been sounded, so perhaps they will suspect nothing. I can pretend to be one of the sailors from that little boat which sank last night. This is a plausible enough story. No one will be able to contradict me since the whole crew is drowned. Let's go." As he said these words, Dantès looked toward the place where the little ship had foundered and shuddered. The Phrygian cap of one of the drowned sailors was hanging from the jagged edge of a rock, and near it some wreckage from the ship's hull was floating. Dead beams that the sea drove against the base of the island, which they hammered like powerless battering rams. In an instant, Dantès had made up his mind. He plunged back into the sea, swam towards the cap, put it on his hat, grasped hold of one of the beams, and set a course that would take him to meet up with the boat. "Now I am saved," he muttered, and this certainly gave him strength. He soon saw the tartan, which, as it was sailing almost directly into the wind, was tacking between the Chateau d'If and the Tour de Planier. For a moment, Dantès was afraid that, instead of hugging the coast, the little ship would head out to sea, as it would have done, for example, had it been bound for Corsica or Sardinia. But from the way it was maneuvering, the swimmer soon realized that it intended to pass between the Isles of Jar and Calceraig. However, the ship and the swimmer were gradually converging. As it tacked in one direction, the little ship even came to about a quarter of a league from Dantès. He rose up in the sea and waved his cap as a distress signal, but no one on the ship saw him, and it went about to begin tacking in the other direction. Dantès thought of calling out, but he assessed the distance and realized that his voice would not reach the ship, but would be carried away on the sea breeze and covered by the noise of the wave. Now he congratulated himself for having had the foresight to lie on a beam. Weak as he was, he might not have been able to keep afloat until he reached the tartan. And certainly, if, as was quite possible, the tartan passed without seeing him, he would not have been able to reach the shore. Though he was almost certain of the course that the boat had set, Dantès looked anxiously after it until the moment when he saw it tack again and returned towards him. Then he swam to meet it, but before their paths had crossed, the boat began to turn. Immediately summoning all his strength, Dantes rose almost out of the water, waved his cap, and gave one of those pitiful cries of a sailor in distress, which sound like the wailing of some genie of the sea. This time he was seen and heard. The tartan changed course and turned towards him. At the same time, he saw that they were preparing to put a boat into the sea. A moment later, the boat, rowed by two men, their oars striking the sea, was coming towards him. Dantes let go of the beam, thinking he would no longer need it, and swam vigorously to half the distance between himself and the saviors. However, he had counted on strength that had almost deserted him. Now he realized how much that piece of wood, already floating inertly 100 yards away, had helped him. His arms began to stiffen, his legs had lost their suppleness. His movements became forced and jerky, and his chest heaved. He let out a great cry. The two rowers increased their efforts, and one called out in Italian, "Coraggio!" The word reached him just as a wave, which he no longer had the strength to ride above, broke over his head and drenched him in spray. He reappeared, thrashing the sea with his uneven, desperate movements of a drowning man, cried out a third time and felt himself sinking into the sea, as if it were still the fatal cannonball attached to his legs. The water closed over his head, and above the water he saw a livid sky speckled with black. One last superhuman effort brought him back to the surface of the sea. Then it seemed to him that someone had grasped him by the hair, and he saw and heard nothing more. He had lost consciousness. When he next opened his eyes, he was on the deck of the tartan, which was underway again. The first thing he did was to look to see what course it was following. It was still sailing away from the Chateau d'If. Dantes was so exhausted that his exclamation of joy was mistaken for a cry of pain. As we said, he was lying on the deck. A sailor was rubbing his limbs with a wooden blanket, while another, whom he recognized as the one who had shouted, "Coraggio," was putting the lip of a gourd to his mouth. A third, an old sailor who was both the pilot and the master, looked at him with the selfish pity that men usually feel towards a misfortune that escaped only the day before and which might be waiting for them on the following one. A few drops of rum from the gourd stimulated the young man's heart, while the massage that the other sailor was still giving him with the wool, kneeling in front of him, gave him some movement back to his limbs. "Who are you?" the master asked in broken French. "I am a Maltese seaman," Dantes replied in broken Italian. "We were sailing from Syracuse with a cargo of wine and paneline. The squall last night surprised us off Cap Morgeau, and we foundered against those rocks that you see over there." "And where have you come from?" "From those same rocks, on which I had the good fortune to wash up, while our poor captain's head was broken against them. Our three companions were drowned. I think I must be the only one left alive. I saw your ship, and fearing that I might have to wait a long time on that isolated desert island, I took my chances on a piece of the wreckage from our boat to try and reach you. Thank you." Dantes went on. "You have saved my life. I was exhausted when one of your sailors grasped me by the hair." "That was me," said a sailor with a frank and open face, framed in long side whiskers. "It was none too soon. You were going under." "Yes," Dantes said, offering his hand. "Yes, my friend, I thank you once more." "Damn it," said the sailor. "I was almost reluctant to do it. With your 6-inch beard and your hair a full foot long, you look more like a brigand than an honest sailor." Dantes remembered that he had indeed not cut his hair or shaved his beard in the whole time he was in the Chateau d'If. "Yes," he said, "this was a vow that I made to Our Lady of Pi della Grata in a moment of danger, to go 10 years without cutting my hair or my beard. Today sees the expiation of my vow, and I nearly drowned on the anniversary of it." "Now what are we going to do with you?" asked the master. "Alas," Dantes replied, "you can do what you like. The felucca on which I was sailing is lost. The captain is dead. As you can see, I escaped his fate, but totally naked. Luckily, I am a fairly good sailor. Put me off as the first part where you make land, and I shall always find employment on some merchant vessel. Do you know the Mediterranean? I've been sailing around it since my childhood. You know the best anchorages? There are a few ports, even the most difficult, where I could not sail in or out with my eyes closed. Well, how about it, patron? Said the sailor had cried Caraggio to Dantes. If what this comrade says is true, why shouldn't he stay with us? Yes, if it is true, said the master, looking doubtful, but in the present state of this poor devil, one may promise a lot, meaning to do what he can. I shall do even more than I have promised, said Dantes. The master laughed. We'll see about that. Wherever you wish, Dantes replied, getting up. Where are you headed? To Leghorn. Well then, instead of tacking and wasting precious time, why don't you simply sail closer into the wind? Because we would be heading directly for the Isle de Rho. You will be more than 120 feet away from it. Take the helm, then, said the master, and let's judge your skill. The young man sat at the helm, touched it lightly to verify that the boat was responsive. Seeing that was reasonably so, though not of the finest class, he said, all hands to the rigging. The four members of the crew ran to their posts while the master looked on. Haul away. The sailors obeyed quite effectively. Now, make fast. This order was carried out as the first two had been, and the little ship, instead of continuing to tack, began to make for the Isle de Rue, passing near it and leaving it off the starboard side at about the distance Dantes had predicted. Bravo, said the master. Bravo, the sailors repeated, all looking with wonder at this man whose face had recovered a look of intelligence and whose bodies possessed a strength that they had not suspected. You see, Dante said, leaving the helm, I might be of some use to you, at least during the crossing. If you want to leave me in Leghorn, you can do so. I shall repay you for my food up to that time, and for the clothes that you will lend me, out of my first month's pay. Very well, then, said the master. We can come to some arrangement if you are reasonable. One man is worth as much as another, said Dantes. Give me what you give to my companions, and we shall be quits. That's not fair, said the sailor who had pulled Dantes out of the sea. You know more than we do. Who the devil asked you? Is this any of your business, Jacopo? Said the master. Every man is free to sign on at the rate which suits him. Correct, said Jacopo. I was just commenting. Well, you wouldn't do better to lend this poor lad a pair of trousers and a jacket, if you had any to spare. He is stark naked. I haven't, said Jacopo, but I do have a shirt and trousers. That is all I need, said Dantes. Thank you, my friend. Jacopo slid down the hatch and returned a moment later with the two articles of clothing, which Dantes was unspeakably happy to put on. Do you need anything else? Asked the master. A scrap of bread and another draught of that excellent rum that you gave me. I have not eaten for a long time. It was, in fact, around 40 hours ago. They brought Dantes a piece of bread, and Jacopo offered him the flask. Hard a port, the captain cried, turning to the helmsman. Dantes looked in the same direction as he put the flask to his lips, but it stopped halfway. Look there, the master exclaimed. What is going on at the Chateau d'If? A little puff of white smoke is what caught Dante's attention. It just appeared above the battlements of the south tower of that fortress. A second later, the sound of a distant explosion reached the tartan. The sailors looked up and exchanged glances. What does that mean? The master asked. Some prisoner escaped last night, said Dantes, and they are firing the warning gun. The master looked at the young man who, as he spoke the words, brought the flask to his lips. He drank the liquid with such calm and satisfaction that, if the master had felt the shadow of a doubt, it would immediately have been dispelled. This rum is devilish strong, Dante said, wiping the sweat from his brow with the sleeve of his shirt. In any case, the master thought, looking at him, even if it is him, so much the better. I have gained a fine man. Pretending that he was tired, Dantes asked if he could sit at the helm. The helmsman, delighted to be relieved of this job, looked at the master, who nodded to let him know that he could hand the bar over to his new companion. From this vantage point, Dantes could remain with his eyes fixed towards Marseille. What day of the month is this? Dantes asked Jacopo, who had come to sit next to him, and they lost sight of the Chateau d'If. February the 28th, he replied. And what year? What do you mean, what year? Are you asking me what year it is? Yes, said the young man. I am asking you the year. You have forgotten what year we are in? What do you expect? I was so terrified last night, Dante said, laughing. I nearly lost my mind. As it is, my memory is troubled. So I'm asking you this. This is the 28th of February of what year? Of the year 1829, said Jacopo. 14 years earlier, to the day, Dantès had been arrested. He had entered the Chateau d'If at the age of 19 and now was emerging from it at 33. A pained smile crossed his lips. He was wondering what had become of Mercedes during this time, when she must have thought him dead. Then a spark of hatred lit up in his eyes when he thought of the three men who were responsible for his long, cruel captivity. And once more he vowed that same implacable oath of vengeance that he had already taken in prison against Danglars, Fernand, and Villefort. By now, the oath was no longer an empty threat, because the finest, fully manned sailing ship in the Mediterranean could surely not have overtaken the little tartan, which was making for Leghorn at full speed. We've run out of time for this hour of The Count of Monte Cristo by Alexandre Dumas, translated by Robin Buss. We'll pick up right where we left off in the next episode. My name is Kelly Wall from North Carolina Reading Service, providing news and information for individuals who are blind or print impaired. Our website is ncreadingservice.org. If you have questions or comments, please call 919-832-5138.